Well, how about that? That little music just stopped there. Hello, welcome back. It's Thursday, the 18th of April, 2024. The weeks get quicker and quicker and quicker. We're nearly into May. Good grief. Is it a third of the year gone by? Could be. This is Paul English Live here on WBN 324 every Thursday, 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. US Eastern, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. in the UK. Last week was pretty much the same as the week before, except busier. Now we got plenty of clips and chat and talk, so this week's show is going to follow pretty much the same format as last week, actually, for all sorts of reasons. And last week's went pretty well, so fingers crossed we'll pull off a good one tonight too. Clips are plenty, and I'm going to try and get a poem in tonight. Not one of my own, so you don't need to get worried or start cringing. And welcome back to Thursdays, eh? And it's they're getting more and more disorienting because it's lighter all the time. Here we are, we've just gone 8 o'clock. I can actually see some light left. Not too much, of course. It's been wonderfully grey and dull and dreary down here for the last few days. People come up to me and say, are you watching the chemtrails? And I never do. I think I've probably sort of experienced most of my life through greyness anyway here in the UK. The weather's just generally grey, so maybe it's going to take an awful long time for the Brits to cotton on to this more fully. But, yeah, every now and again, because I'm on the coast, we do get clear skies, and then they sort of cloud over really rather quickly. But then I'm thinking, am I being overly paranoid? And I might be being overly paranoid, I don't know. So those sorts of things do crop up from time to time in conversation. One of the things, one pointless and really rather silly conversation, something for you to think about throughout the show, I think, maybe tonight. Oh, look at that. Go away. There we go. I just wanted to do something silly right at the beginning, you know, that's my style. Quick shout out to everybody in Rumble. I've got to find out how I can actually see everybody in Rumble. Do I click something somewhere? Probably do. But to Caddy7 and to Eric and anybody else that's piling into the chat or is listening over there in Rumble, big shout out. I'll have a look again as we go through. So, hi Warren, good evening or good afternoon, depending on where you are. Welcome back. So I'll be watching out in the chat tonight. I put a little note in actually about 40 minutes ago because I was early fiddling around with my, you know, technicals as you do prior to a show. And although we can pull music out of a hat round here, I actually haven't put any in the hat so far for the show tonight. So if there's a tune, if you get the urge, you know, and you think, well, there's a tune I'd like to hear. And you think it might be palatable and won't distress people too much, then lob it in to the chat over on Rumble. And that's probably the best way to go about dealing with these things. Paul B will be joining me shortly. He might even be here, but he'll be joining me shortly. We've got a few things to go over. Well, I've got loads of clips, actually, and little poems, as I said. We might get more than two poems tonight. I just thought we'd have a bit of a change of pace. And also Patrick Chanel should be joining us a little bit later. I've just got to sort him out a little bit technically, because he just sent me a message just before the show saying, how do I join it? Or how do we come into CleanFeed? Patrick, actually, if you're listening to this, the way you get into the show, look at this, I'm sort of covering myself. The way you get into the show, if you head on over to paulenglishlive.com, and at the bottom of the page, you'll see a green link there that says something like studio, or when the show's live, to join the studio, or to call in. I think that's what it is. If you click that, it'll pull you into the show. Anyway, if you didn't hear this, you won't know what I'm talking about, but there we go. I've got more stuff this week about the environment until we all go crazy with it, but it is funny, some of these things, some of these comments, really looking at them effectively, saying all the things that we're saying, but of course putting a negative spin on it, as if they're still pushing this whole nonsense about carbon dioxide being... Well, there's just too much of it, isn't there, everyone? There's far too much carbon dioxide. And yet, you know, the trees still love it. They still love the carbon dioxide. Now, I was talking just there about a poem. I'm going to start us off with... This is a good one, though. This is a good one. By the way, when I come to actually plan these things out, the golden rule is there isn't much of a plan. I've got a splurge of, like, tabs open here with all sorts of... things that I just generally find interesting. And so this is why we hop back and forth across the topics, which I think is fine, really. It's a bit like being in a pub, isn't it? Slowly losing your thread after 15 minutes, then you start talking about the same thing about an hour later. Stuff like that. Where was my little screen of loveliness? Okay, so I wanted to... You might have heard of a chap called... This is really rather chunky. I love this. I might have read this out before, but I'm going to read it again. This is Rudyard Kipling. You may have heard of him. He was quite famous. In fact, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature back in the 1920s. But, of course, he's slightly frowned upon these days and poo-pooed. But he wrote... I don't know when he actually wrote this one, and it's not long. And I'll tell you the title of it afterwards, because it's best to just read it. And many of you may have already heard it. I don't know. You may have already heard this poem. It's 5 verses, each verse 6 lines. So there you go. But this has force to it. Here we go. He wrote one day, I guess somewhere, in wonderful Sussex, which is where he was. The stranger within my gate, he may be true or kind, but he does not talk my talk. I cannot feel his mind. I see the face... and the eyes, and the mouth, but not the soul, behind. The men of my own stock, they may do ill or well, but they tell the lies I am wanted to. They are used to the lies I tell, and we do not need interpreters when we go to buy and sell. The stranger within my gates, he may be evil or good, but I cannot tell what powers control, what reasons sway his mood, nor when the gods of his far-off land shall repossess his blood. The men of my own stock, bitter bad they may be, but at least they hear the things I hear and see the things I see. And whatever I think of them and their likes, they think of the likes of me. This was my father's belief, and this is also mine. Let the corn be all one sheaf, and the grapes be all one vine, ere our children's teeth are set on edge by bitter bread and wine. Somebody said there that they remember Mr. Kipling's cakes. Well, there is a brand over here called Kipling's Cakes. It might still be chugging along. I've read that poem on and off for years. It seems more and more apt with each passing moment here in the UK, in Europe and elsewhere. Kipling, of course, is classed as a highly politically incorrect writer now, and so that's why he's not given too much credence. But he's bang on with this. And I would say whichever race or nation you're in, this poem is appropriate for you, wherever you are. you could read it with regards to your own people and the outcome of your own people and the strength of your families, whichever race you're from. This is the key thing, it seems to me. And of course, it lends a lot of force against the lie that is always thrown at us, people that are concerned about their own nation, that they're racists. So I'm trying to find different ways, you see, to address this very thorny problem, which apparently we're not allowed to talk about too directly, because otherwise it's going to be, whether we like it or not, interpreted as hate. This is what occurs. It's going to be interpreted as hate, and we are going to be cast as haters. Oh, well, never mind. What can you do? The real haters, of course, and I'm going to, I guess I'm just going to keep re-emphasizing this point, and we all need to keep re-emphasizing it, I guess, in our own thoughts, is that those who seek to create this world of diversity, who say things like diversity is our strength, they're not lying, by the way, when they say that, but that they don't mean quite what the audience thinks it means. The people that are pushing that are, it seems to me, the biggest haters of them all. So how come that we are not able to have them in courts answering for their hate crimes against all the different races of the earth as they seek to admix them together to destroy all of them? That's really what they're doing. And just going back to that little phrase, you know, Tony Blair used to drone on about this, but he's not the only one. They all got their hymn sheet, I suppose, sent through in the mail, didn't they? Diversity is our strength. The code there is when they use the word our, they're referring to them and their coterie of psychopathic. Nah, that doesn't do it, does it? I'm fed up, I'm bored with that word. Their coterie of whatever. You insert your own adjectives, okay? Because we're going to run out of them to describe their behaviour. Very, very bad, naughty people. How about that? That's pathetic, isn't it? They're talking about their own peer group. Diversity is our strength, they say. Of course it is. It's their strength. Because what it does is it depletes our strength. People over here on the other side of things. And I know last week I was mentioning a little bit about the ownership of land here in the UK. Me and Paul were discussing it. He might step in at some point, which is fine. You can do, Paul. Anytime you feel like piping up, just jump in. But I'm going to repeat a fact from last week as well, because I think it's worth repeating. When the records were retaken of land ownership in England in the 1860s, this guy that wrote the book, John Bateman, or a series of books that were very well received and sold out tremendously, he found that landowners, people owning 3,000 acres and more, 4,000 families owned 50% of the UK or England. Maybe it included Scotland too. It probably did. 4,000. And 95% of the people owned nothing. And that's, what, 150, 160 years ago? It's not too far off. It doesn't seem too far off to me in these hectic times. So that that line, that division between them and us, which we've all known has always existed, there is, sitting there, right royal and pretty, right in the data. And I've yet to get through any more of that particular book. I will be doing. I'll probably bring you more information from it as I get through it. I'm about 60 pages through the thing. It's about 250 pages or something. So I'm trying to jump around and mark it all up with biros as we go. But I think this is key stuff. It's absolutely key stuff. So let's just have... Oh, we've got some little flurry of comments coming in. How about that? I can't read that one out, Catty. We can't talk about Adolf's birthday being in 2 days' time. I'll get locked up for that. There'll probably be the birthday police. There's got to be a division formed for that as well. Eric writes, when people accuse me of being a racist, I deliberately misunderstand and take it as a compliment, thinking a racist is a person that looks young and fit and does racing. Well, that's one take on it, Eric. I guess that is one take on the whole thing. But how about this one as a take? How about this? So people that love capitalism are known as capitalists, right? And people that love communism, boo. I should have said boo after capitalism as well, really, because they're both a bit of a mess. Communism, of course, is a savage mess. They're known as communists. People that love communism are known as communists. And people that love their nation are known as nationalists. So people that love their own race are racists, right? Except, of course, we all know, do we not? For we are reading the press and we are being formed and taught by our masters, courtesy of the mainstream media, that only white people can be racist, which is a bit of a puzzle. I mean, that seems to be as if they're giving a privilege. I mean, is it a good thing to only be racist? I don't think it is, you know. I think all people naturally must be racists. I don't see what the problem is. But, of course, they spin it in this negative light. This is the thing that Kipling was addressing in many ways, you know, in this poem about the stranger. The fact is that if there were these tremendous examples throughout history of the admixing of races on the same bit of real estate for permanent living, cheek by chowl, working, actually working, then it would have naturally occurred a long time ago. It would have just come about. But it doesn't work. It's not designed to work. Not only is it not designed to work, it's not actually required. It's totally surplus to the requirements of nature. Nature doesn't want it. In fact, nature, of course, operates in such a way as to push against it and to stop it. And it gives you instincts about these things, which, of course, I suppose we could say since World War II, courtesy of the mainstream media, these instincts of people have been massively overridden by the permanent 24/7 indoctrination courtesy of TV, media, and the monkey thing. You know, what we do, we see what monkey see, monkey do, that kind of thing. So we can't underestimate the drip, drip, drip permanent power of that stuff. And I'm sure most listeners here don't underestimate it, actually. But we're also in this positive space as well, are we not? Courtesy of the COVID attack, the wedging of war, courtesy of COVID, where many people have been aroused to see this and to slowly engage with topics which pre-2020, a lot of people would have been out of the room like a shot. In fact, I used to do it as a test. I might have mentioned it before. How fast can you clear a room? How fast do you want to clear a room? Well, you go into polite company, you just start talking about race. It'll clear pretty quickly. Even now, I would have thought it would. It's probably the fastest way. You know, if you've got a doorway that's jammed with people, you've got a bit of a people flow problem, just stand in the corner, start talking about race. They'll all clear off faster than you can say Jack Robinson, whoever he may be. And speaking of monkeys, okay, this is a really important conversation I was having earlier this week with someone in my family, one of my sons. We were discussing what's the best ever monkey film. What do you think is the best film that's got a monkey in it? Right? I don't know why we were talking about it, but there's something about monkeys, isn't there? Or is it about King Kong? So, of course, that might be the first one that leapt into your mind or roared into your ear. I don't know. He seemed to think that the monkey from Night at the Museum was the best one. There's a little capuchin monkey in that. I've forgotten his name, that slaps someone like crazy. So you can see we're gonna be covering some really important and deep topics tonight. But maybe you want to have a think about that. If anybody thinks they know what's the best film ever with a monkey in it, what's the top monkey film ever? I suppose you could say maybe one with the monkeys in, that pop group that was manufactured in the 1960s. But then so were the Beatles, weren't they? And so were many of the other sorts of things manufactured as well. Paul, are you there? I've done my opening shot. Are you there? Would you like to step in and say hello? Oh, you are saying hello, but I've got you muted, so this is great. Watch me press the right button now.
Yes, you do.
There we go. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
How did you press the right button?
I did. I've got too many buttons and not enough fingers. And I'm also, I've got one of my fingers is deformed viciously. It isn't really. I just always ham it up. But yeah. So what kind of a week have you been having?
Oh, I've been having a pretty good week. It's, well, there have been rolling blackouts in the area where the host of the show that I do 6 days a week.
Oh, yeah.
Those rolling blackouts have basically meant I'm playing archives and he's just fuming because his lights are all out. But I don't know what my favorite monkey movie is.
I'm keen to hear.
But I do know that it was almost a premonition. It was almost like One of the great prognosticators of the world, and it was the person that wrote a book that actually predicted Biden being elected as president. And of course, the book that I'm talking about is Curious George Goes to Washington.
Yeah.
Now, was that turned, that's was my that favorite turned into a book.
Film? That was turned into a film, was it? Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's my favorite book.
All right. Yeah. No,
it was almost like an Edgar Casey moment when that book hit the shelves. I mean, honestly,
I've got a great Edgar Casey book somewhere floating around the house. It's been one of the rooms because every room I've got in the house is full of books. I liked Casey, very interesting guy. It's one of those things that just grab your attention. I don't think he wrote much about monkeys, though, did he? And I don't know why we got carried away about monkeys.
No, I don't believe he did.
Why is it? What is it with them when they come on to, you know, when, is it David Attenborough or Richard? No, Richard was the director and the actor. David, who's still chugging along, good old chap, even though they've kind of hijacked him and roped him into the environmental bullshit business, which they wanted to do, so they must put a bit of pressure on him. But there was that great one where he was, I don't know if you saw it over there, there's a great one where he was rolling around with gorillas. I think that was in the late 70s or early 80s. He went out and just hung out with gorillas, fascinating things. And there's something captivating about monkeys. I don't know what it is. I mean, this is not a really heavy or deep topic. We don't have to spend the whole evening talking about monkeys, but it did. It came up the other day and I just thought, yeah, there is something about them, really. There really is. I've wanted some in the garden for some time. Did I mention this to you?
No, you didn't. But I think the amazing thing about monkeys is that they're in some ways so similar to people, but in other ways so completely different. So they really do hit both sides of the spectrum, and you really don't know what to expect out of them at any moment.
No.
I think that might be it.
I think Eric might have actually picked the best the best monkey film. He's very close. Although Paul, you're probably going to want to put a stake in this from your side of the pond. Eric writes the best monkey film is the daily televised UK Parliament Chimps Tea Party. He might be right, Eric. You're actually pretty close to that. Oh. Although that's a bit of an insult to monkeys. Frankly,
we have that.
Yeah. Do you? What do you have?
We have that on C-SPAN.
Yeah.
We have that on C-SPAN, so, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, Warren, you're right.
Eric did make a song choice.
Yes.
Yeah, Eric made a song choice, but I don't think we're going to be able to get to that because shortest version, I mean, that's an actual orchestral work, and it goes anywhere from 15 minutes to an hour. Now, unless we wanted to put on the 58 minute and fit. Wagner's Tannhäuser.
Oh, you're a troublemaker, Eric. It's outrageous. We can't have that.
Yeah, well, minutes. We could put on the 58-minute version and just head down to the pub for a cold one and then come back by the time it ends, you know. We could do that.
Yeah, okay. Probably a little bit too long for tonight. Break. Maybe we'll do a special Wagnerian edition and we can do the Rings of the Nibelung and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, we'll do the whole lot, you know, and we'll make it a full one day show. The whole lot. A few comments about David Attenborough here, Paul. David Attenborough is a global warming pusher, complete Muppet. Well, not complete. I can't help but have a soft spot for him for all the good work he's done. And I think, like I was saying, I think he's just been roped in. They put pressure on these guys. How old is he now? He's 90 odd. He's still doing coherent work, but they started to make him introduce this nonsense with regards to climate and this, that, and the other. When did I first notice it? I don't know. I don't watch that much TV, but I suspect it's been happening over the last 5 to 10 years, basically. And they're always banging on about this stuff. And of course, if they can get it coming out of his mouth, well, it carries so much more weight. It carries so much more weight with all that kind of stuff. But yeah, well, maybe there should be a fight between, we need a competition, maybe one of these TV things, you know, where people vote for which is the most silly communication space, the UK Houses of Parliament or wherever your guys talk. Where do they talk? What's the place where your guys shout at one another? Do they have one?
Just the House.
The House.
Senate. But you can catch it all on C-SPAN.
So. Yeah. You're not selling it to me, Paul. I'm not too keen to do that.
Well, hey, don't shoot the messenger. Jeez. Yeah.
No, absolutely. I'm just trying to find. I must have a pretty. I must have an environment. Oh, here's one. Look, here, this will do. It's 1 minute and 20 seconds. Let me. This is from Boris Johnson's dad. Everybody, hooray, Boris Johnson's dad. Now, Boris Johnson was the guy that was apparently the Prime Minister. Let's listen to this, if we can. Let's see what he says.
This report, which you've just referred to, Nala, is so extremely important because the idea it is getting across is that there's a global carbon budget out there. You know, it is 40 billion tons, gigatons a year. And if we don't keep to that, actually, we've got to go, we've got to shave that down year after year. We run out of steam by 2030, you know, so it's absolutely vital.
But this is all kind of based on modelling, isn't it? So we do these modelling and stuff. Don't we have to be careful that our modelling is actually correct? Because a lot of the modelling, so for example, the modelling during the pandemic, we got that completely wrong, and it was so way off the mark. Don't we have to be careful that our modelling, because the outcome that we're predicting using our current modelling...
Well, you've got 100 top scientists out there behind this report, and one thing is not modelling, which is actually measuring the increase in the presence of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That is an absolute fact. I mean, I think we're on about 418 ppm, and the pre-industrial level was half that. So that is a fact. Now, it's the implications of that, which of course does require modelling, and I think they've pretty much got it right. You see it. I travel around the world the whole time, and you can just see the effects of it: the floods, the drought. The melting of the glaciers. So it actually means that countries need to divvy up this carbon budget between them, and then they need to divvy up the sectors, and then they need to have the measures which deal sector by sector with getting the... And if that means, actually, some of us are told, well, you can't go on a plane, that's fine. That's part of the national plan.
I travel around the world the whole time.
This report, which you've just referred to...
Well, that was very weird, wasn't it? Anyway, that was Boris Johnson's dad talking... Manure. I was going to be very vulgar then, but many of the... What did he refer to there? 100 scientists. I wonder who pays them. They can't be very good at science, can they? I mean, really. I know we were talking about this last week, Paul, but it's worth just coming back to on a regular little basis. The whole idea that they're pushing out this permanent lie, this total nonsense by wheeling out gimps like this guy, Johnson's dad. He wrote a book, you know, some years ago. I can't remember what it was. Was it about a virus wiping loads of people out? I mean, what are these people? Are they ever happy? Why do they have some sort of intelligent ideas? But of course, they're not really going to do that, are they? They're not really going to have intelligent ideas. I don't think they are. I don't think they're going to have any intelligent ones at all.
That was Boris Johnson's dad talking rubbish.
Yes.
We're actually short of CO2. Plants need it. And when the plants don't have it, the plants die. When the plants die, they don't create oxygen. And when there's no oxygen, we die.
Yep. It's not difficult, is it? I think, so he's crying about 114 parts per million. Not enough. I want a million parts per million. We want nothing but more carbon dioxide. There's a great Simpsons thing where Bart was trying to be popular at school, and he started coming up with a chant about more asbestos, and they got all the class. He was just being counter against whatever was being put out. But that clip leads me to this quote from a gentleman called Frederick Bastiat. If you're not familiar with him, you are now. I'll spell that surname, Bastiat. Frederick with a C, just one C, Frederick Bastiat, fantastic guy, wrote some brilliant stuff, French, excellent stuff. Here's a little quote from him that's kind of in line with that. He says, "If the natural tendencies of mankind are so bad that it is not safe to permit people to be free, how is it that the tendencies of these organisers, like Boris Johnson's dad, are always good? Do not the legislators and their appointed agents also belong to the human race? Or do they believe that they themselves are made of a finer clay than the rest of mankind?" Well, Frederick, I think you answered your own question. It's the last one. Yes, they do think they're made of a finer clay than the rest of mankind. Do you not think, Paul?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I actually do. And
you do.
I was muted, but my assistant spoke up just as you called my name, and I'm going, okay, if I unmute now, everybody in the world is going to know that I have Alexa in my living room.
Is that what was going on? Oh, actually, I'm glad you did mute that. That would have been very weird. I wouldn't have been able to think for 3 or 4 minutes after that. I'm finding it hard enough as it is, absolutely, to do that. Bastiat wrote some tremendous things. Absolutely brilliant. I've got to give you this other quote while we're here. I might even do this twice in the show. It's that good. And if you don't know this quote, you'll know it now, and you may have seen it before. This is fantastic. This describes our situation so spot on in terms of the legal constraints, or so-called legal constraints, that are placed upon us. He wrote this: when plunder becomes a way of life, men create for themselves a legal system that authorizes it and a moral code that glorifies it. You must have heard that before, Paul, I think. You must have heard that. No?
Oh, absolutely.
It's so spot on. You can't wheel these things out often enough, really. I mean, it's just absolutely... So the moral code that they're glorifying right now, they're doing that courtesy of the mainstream media, because they are so moral and so much better than the rest of us. And they are, you know, really looking after us. And we all feel that, don't we? We really feel the love coming from these people and their kindliness and their warm vision for a good Earth and for all the different races on the Earth. We don't feel anything like that at all. I see that we are joined by Patrick Chanel. So let me bring him into the room, and hopefully it'll be fine. Patrick, hello, good afternoon.
Yeah, hey.
Hey.
You can hear me. Good.
Yeah, we can hear you. You sound fine. Yeah. I might even give you an extra decibel, you know, which is quite nice, isn't it? Getting an extra decibel like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for free?
Yeah, for free.
An extra. I feel slighted.
You're free. So, everybody, if you've not heard Patrick Chanel, he does a few shows and is a good friend, and we're part of a... Look, everybody's name here in the group begins with P. I just thought you ought to know. If your name doesn't begin with P, you can still call in later on, don't worry. But right now we've got Paul, Patrick, and Paul. So, or something like that is the thing. But Patrick, are you out in the field then? Literally?
No.
No?
No. I'm at my broadcast desk right now.
Oh, wow.
I didn't want to call in on my phone because I had bad service, you know.
Yeah.
Bad signal. So,
yeah. Cool.
I figured I'd call in and respect your audience enough so you're not always asking, hey, are you there? Hello? Hello? You know, kind of thing.
Wow.
No, it's good to hear you, Paul.
Yeah, you too, Patrick. It's good. It's been a busy little week. So, those of you... you've not been on before, have you? Actually, I did that group thing a few months ago. Were you on that? I'm sorry for forgetting. I think you might have been. There was quite a large cluster of us around a Christmas show, I think. Were you in on that show, possibly?
Yeah.
I can't remember. Oh, cool.
Yeah, with Andy?
Yeah, that's right. That's a few months ago. And I'd spoken to Andy Hitchcock as well earlier this week. I hadn't spoken to him for quite a while. A very long call. Lots of fun. We didn't talk about monkeys. We've done enough talking about monkeys already. So no monkey chat in that call, which was fine. And this message in the chat is...
No anthropomorphizing?
No, what's that?
Monkeys? Sorry. Anthropomorphizing? Why? Making monkeys out to be men?
Well,
men
there is
to
that.
Be monkeys?
Yeah, well, we were trying to discuss what's the best film that's got a monkey in it. You know, and of course, everybody... probably thinks King Kong or Mighty Joe Young. Do you remember that thing from the 50s or whenever it was? I remember seeing that when I was about 7. I cried when the big monkey was... It was not a good day. I don't really want to talk about that again. It's really rather embarrassing.
Was that a Ray Harryhausen animation thing?
I think it was. Yeah, one of those stop-motion things with Ray Harryhausen. Very captivating. Someone here, there's a troublemaker, has written, is actually watching football on the TV whilst listening. Hi, Night and Day. Fantastic. Welcome to the show. So, catching the show, but also watching Liverpool versus Atalanta in the Europa Cup. Well,
who's he rooting for?
I don't think we want
Atalanta.
This is all very sad, really. People watching football. What's going on? You know, I have no idea what that's all about. Absolutely bizarre behavior.
Isn't you'll never walk alone? Isn't that the Liverpool theme?
It is. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
how'd they
is.
Come up with that? Isn't that an American song?
You'll never walk alone. I don't know. Is it? Was it?
I think so.
Well, it was released by some band in the 60s, and then they adopted it as an anthem up at Anfield, and they all sing it. But Night and Day, I believe, is a Spurs supporter, but we don't want to go there. The whole chat will just turn into a big football thing. This is terrible. It's going to get hijacked. I don't know what to say. Yeah. So, Patrick, anything interesting going on with you recently?
Oh, besides work? Well, work is kind of interesting.
Yeah?
You know, what do you do when the work you're working for is selling to a country that's bombing people? You know?
Is that what
that's kind of what's going on with my work. It's like, what do I do? You know, do I continue to work there or do I give it up?
Really? You're in a bit of a trap, are you? You don't need to explain, but I understand. It is a kind of. You won't be the only person in that. Do we call that a moral dilemma? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Mm.
I'd say so.
Yeah.
But yeah, besides that, pigs. We can talk about pigs.
And I've got to tell the viewers something about you and the pigs, so you have to forgive me, Patrick.
Yeah, go ahead.
So when I first connected up with Patrick, probably, 5 or 6 months ago, maybe, summer of last year, something like that, and other people had told me what a terrible person you were, but I didn't let that put me off, and we ended up talking, didn't we? And then the first photographs you sent me were of these, was of your, you'd just been killing
abattoir.
Yeah, you'd been out there. You're a man of the earth, aren't you? You're a man of the farming world. You're a man of the livestock world, and you've been out there making pigs meet their maker
I never really intended it. I was kind of roped into it, but I kind of enjoy it now. It's not so bad. It's an occupation I could take with me anywhere in the world and have work.
I guess you could. Well, as long as they still allow pigs to thrive.
Well, you don't need to have just pigs. You know, it could be sheep. It could be cattle. I've done plenty of cattle. So, I'm not limited in that regard. So, yeah. But once you know how to do it, it's quite the skill to have, I'd say. Because you could go anywhere. You can barter. You can trade. You could be in, like, tribal areas of some remote, you know, jungle, and you could still get by.
I guess the... the more earthy aspect of farming, such as... or livestock farming, such as slaughtering animals, you know, to go to market, is something, of course, that we're all so distant from now because we buy all our food, or have been, or maybe we very soon won't be able to buy all our food in these delightful plastic packages courtesy of the supermarket. So we become very distanced from the actual natural, you know, condition of meat. It was much better, really, I think, in a butcher's, where you used to get everything all laid out. Even as a kid, it was like, ooh, what's that? You know, but most of us, of course, are completely, ooh, I couldn't possibly do that. And we get quite squeamish about it. And yet, without it, there wouldn't be any steak on the plate, would there, once a month?
Burgers.
Yeah.
Bacon.
Oh, yeah, bacon. I've given up on bacon. I had to stop. I'm not allowed to eat pigs. So I stopped eating them. You can read into that, listeners, what you will. I now get chicken sausages. How about that? Anyway, chicken sausages. Do you want to hear something about the Federal Reserve and central bank currencies?
Tell us.
Here we go. Here's a little clip. And this is quite revealing, again, about CBDC. They're going to hop around on the thing. This is from a few weeks ago. President of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, Neil Kashkari. It's almost like, but it's Kashkari, not with the C, Kashkari. Let's just listen to this. It's not a very long clip. I think it's about a
minute. Central bank digital currency. Do you think that is something that you all should be looking into seriously? To what degree should you be looking into it seriously? Just what are your thoughts on CBDC?
I mean, as my colleagues at the Federal Reserve have talked about, we are examining it. I'll tell you, my personal bias is I'm pretty skeptical. I keep asking anybody at the Fed or outside of the Fed to explain to me what problem this is solving. I can send anybody in this room $5 with Venmo right now. Right? No, seriously. So what is it that a CBDC could do that Venmo can't do? And all I get is a bunch of hand waving. I get a bunch, well, maybe it's better for financial inclusion. Maybe it's better for cross-border remittances. Maybe. Is there any evidence that it is? And, you know, they say, well, what about China? China's doing it. Well, I can see why China would do it. If they want to monitor every one of your transactions, You could do that with a central bank digital currency. You can't do that with Venmo. If you want to impose negative interest rates, you could do that with a central bank digital currency. You can't do that with Venmo. And if you want to directly tax customer accounts, you could do that with a central bank digital currency. You can't do that with Venmo. So I get why China would be interested. Why would the American people be for that?
Wow. Didn't he say the truth there? What do you think?
Yeah, I think he's but what is the ultimate goal of him? You know, what does he want as the Federal Reserve head of the bank, Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, which is near me?
Well, I don't know. He seems to be telling the truth there, doesn't he? They're gonna, you know, there are gonna be some that tell the truth.
Maybe they already control Venmo as a CBDC. Maybe Bitcoin is a CBDC, and it would just be a, you know, further confusion.
What is Venmo, by the way? It's the first time I've ever heard of it. Is it a payment system or something in the States?
It's like an online payment type system, like PayPal.
All right.
I think it might even be related somehow to PayPal.
Yeah.
But it's all Swift system.
Right. Okay. Well, the insidious nature of it is everybody has probably heard of geofencing. So geofencing is this technical thing where, you know, we'll use the mobile phone because apparently it is a phone that you carry around with you, although people aren't as mobile as they used to be because they'll just sit in our houses for the last 4 years. But let's assume you still move around a bit with your phone. They can actually set it up so that, for example, if they don't want it to work in Staffordshire, for example, and who would want it to work in Staffordshire? No, I don't know why I even said
sanctions.
That. Yeah, they can stop you being connected. They can switch things on and off on your phone, all of this kind of stuff. And, of course, we kind of know that this is what they want to do. But that's really the main purpose of a CBDC. If it gets in, it's nothing to do with actual improved banking because the only way to improve the bank is to burn it to the ground and start again. But it's to micromanage every aspect of your life. I know I'm probably preaching to the choir here, but at least he said something sensible. Whether he is just a sop to us to keep us happy. Oh, look, like me, I'm doing right now. Oh, look, here's a really intelligent man from the Federal Reserve in Minneapolis telling us that there's really no purpose of CBDCs at all, yet the argument will still keep drifting in their direction because it isn't really a genuine argument. It's this condition that we're in where we have no opportunity to really have them work for us. They have assumed, you know, full total spectrum control over everything because, as Bastiat said, you know, they're better than us, aren't they?
I think there should be some regulation, though, in regards to these cryptocurrency exchanges, because what happens if a cryptocurrency exchange doesn't want to give you your money and they just lock you out and you have no way of communicating with them, because many of these don't have a physical address tied to their business. It's all over the place. So I think there should be some sort of regulation on that state by state.
Yeah.
But, you know, like you remember Stephen Mitford Goodson and the idea of having a state bank, like North Dakota State Bank is like one of the few state banks in the United States, if not the only one.
Yep.
Where they could print their own money if they wanted to.
And of course, they have a very solid account book, don't they? So this is North Dakota. Yeah, I've been aware of this.
North Dakota.
Yeah. So of
course, a lot of oil and farming.
Mm-hmm. And very few people are aware of this bank in North Dakota because the other banking systems don't want you to be aware of it, but it exists.
Yeah.
And
it was started in 1919.
Yeah. And it works. I've got a book on the way I've got four or five now. I'm going mad, actually. I won't be able to move again soon. But there's actually, Patrick, we were talking about this gentleman earlier in the week, Michael Hudson, an economist over in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, New York.
Yeah, very bright guy. Where is he? Yale or something like that, or Harvard. He's one of those. He's out of that space, and he works with a kind of peer group. He's one of the few people that basically spotted 2008 before it happened with the great long-term capital management meltdown of everything. He's written a book called And Forgive Them Their Debts, and I'm gagging to get this book, although there's a sort of little reverse story in it as well. But what he's talking about is a connection between scriptural economic law, let's call it that, and why it worked in the past. And actually also the main sort of focus, what he's saying. Yeah, let me read you this thing from the blurb on the book, or the little on his site. And his website, by the way, for those that are interested, michael-hudson.com. Okay. The book is called And Forgive Them Their Debts, Lending, Foreclosure and Redemption from Bronze Age Finance to the Jubilee Year. And you'll have heard me talk about Jubilee and other people talk about Jubilee. He says this. In And Forgive Them Their Debts, renowned professor of economics Michael Hudson, and one of the few who could see the 2008 financial crisis coming, takes us on an epic journey through the economies of ancient civilizations. For the past 40 years, in conjunction with the Harvard Peabody Museum, he and his colleagues have documented the archaeological record and history of debt, and how societies have dealt with, or failed to deal with, the proliferation of debts that cannot be paid. In the pages of And Forgive Them Their Debts, readers will discover shocking historical truths about how debt played a central role in shaping ancient societies. Perhaps most striking of all is that, in a nearly complete consensus of Assyriologists, and I personally don't know any Assyriologists, so we'll have to go along with that, and biblical scholars, Here's a line for you. The Bible is preoccupied with debt, not sin. So I'm very keen to get my hands on this. And if it turns out to be as good as that little blurb has got me salivating about, then I'll be talking about it quite a bit in this show in the weeks to come. I won't have it for a few days yet, and it's going to take me a little while to get through it. But as I've mentioned before, my entire connection into looking at Scripture, for me personally, came through looking at banking. I've always thought it was a bit odd. So a book like this is like, oh, you wrote this personally for me, did you? That's what I thought when I saw it. Yes. You know? Yeah.
His main claim to fame was a book called Super Imperialism.
Right.
From the 70s. And that's basically telling us about the World Bank and IMF system and how it's an extension of the American military. Like certain IMF or World Bank chiefs have always been high-ranking chiefs of staff of the military here. Mm-hmm. And loans to other countries a lot of times are stipulated based on military needs.
Yes.
So to speak.
Well, they the biggest purchaser and expender of money, the military? They're a pretty big part of it, aren't they?
Yeah,
and so many industries feed into
education.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. And the education goes hand in hand with it. As far as his new book, I've heard him talk about it before, Michael Hudson. He does a lot of talking about the Byzantine Empire and the banking in that structure, but it predates it in the Code of Hammurabi. I think he kind of starts there and then works his way through the Byzantines, which are kind of the ideal in his outlook as far as forgiving debts, the 50-year jubilee cycle.
Yep.
As a way to clear debts and create peace without having to go to war to collect debt, which has been the cycle we've been in through the 20th century, is going in.
Yes.
You're basically a debt collector at a certain point. And if you have a system based on usury, it's never going to balance out. So you're always going to be in a perpetual war state if you don't forgive the debts.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's biblical because the Our Father prayer mentions forgive us our debts as we forgive those who have a debt to us, as we forgive our debtors.
Yes.
So we say trespasses, it's just another way of saying it. But yeah, like you say, it's just, sin is debt in a way.
Well, you mentioning the Byzantine situation has got me drooling even more. I've realized just how odd I am. Don't you think? It's a bit strange. It's kind of esoteric to most people out here, but I think it's absolutely key.
Well, modern-day Russia is based on the Byzantine Empire. A lot of it still, to this day, you know, in the church. Their church is more Byzantine than the Western churches tend to be.
Well, there is this fact, this truth about the Byzantine Empire that it's, A, not talked about much at all. It's certainly not taught there was no mention of it at all during my history classes at school. Not that I was paying too much attention. I was spending most of my time drawing little things on the pictures inside the books, because when you opened them up, you found that lots of graffiti had been going on in all these books for years, and you just wanted to add to it. So, of course, it's very wrong. I should have been paying attention. But I'm pretty sure we didn't do anything about the Byzantines or the Byzantium or anything like that. And yet it is the longest-lasting empire we know of, longer than Egypt or anything. It's from about 300 to 1500, something. It's about 1200 years all the way through.
Yeah, so Constantinople turned into Istanbul.
That's right. Is it Istanbul or Constantinople? There's a song, Paul. We need to dig that one up. Who was that by? Do you remember that one? American band.
Yeah, they hate.
Who did that? Is it Istanbul?
Oh, I know.
Constantinople, is it Istanbul? Dun, 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 dun. Sorry, I liked it. It was a very good song. I can't remember the name
of
it.
You find it, send it to me. I'll convert it.
It's my brain. Will my brain find it, Paul? It's not working very well. I can't. Anybody know the song? I'm desperately singing badly. Yeah, they're a fantastic little band.
I've been trying to get in here for a minute.
Yeah, go on, please. Blast away. Kick us off, Paul. Come on.
Okay, well, I was listening to that clip, and I picked absolutely the wrong time to go make a pot of coffee, because I was listening to that clip, and I was loaded for bear by the time I got back to my computer. However, there wasn't any way to get in because my mute was stuck. Anyways, I think it's very, very interesting that he used the word Venmo like five or six times,
yes,
because not what a whole lot of people know is Venmo is a PayPal company. Okay, and PayPal is so far up the Internal Revenue Service, the individuals representing Satan's backside, that if you don't have actually a business EIN number attached to your PayPal account, they'll just go ahead and withhold 24% of any funds that come into your PayPal account, and they'll happily send it right off to the IRS. Now, Venmo is exactly the same as PayPal. They're two sides of the same bent coin. So the reason I've got to wonder, he would use the word Venmo five times. He's trying to put it in people's heads. It's soft conditioning. Oh, wow, he's saying that Venmo is better than CDBC or CBDC. I'd better go get a Venmo account right away. Why? It's a PayPal company.
Yeah, they already own it. They already control it, just like Bitcoin, in my opinion.
So you saying, exactly, Paul, that he's just another evil banker? Bull. Is that what you're saying? Is he another one?
Absolutely. Yes. He's a
rat. I thought we'd
he's
found
not even
on this
controlled
one.
Opposition. He's not even controlled opposition. He's
that's great.
He's daft.
Paul, I sent you a song. Oh.
There's someone in the chat, right, has found the song, and I've got it. You haven't got time to process it, Paul, because we're coming up to the break. We've only got 5 minutes, and I'm going to play it.
Is it the Four Lads?
No, no.
Oh,
who do you think the band is? Vin Landerson has given us the clue.
Okay,
if I had some toffees, Vin Landerson,
here,
I'd send them to you. It'd ruin your teeth, but there we
I'm
go.
I'm forwarding it to you, Paul.
What are you sending to me?
The Four Lads.
I don't know.
I found a version.
To you what Patrick just sent to me.
Yeah.
Honestly.
No, it's not the Four Lads. Okay, it's not. All right. So it might be great what you found, but that's not what I'm going to play in about 5 minutes' time. So there we go. It's really good. I've got it here. Anyway, I've just found the song. Got it. It'll sound great. This is going to be good. So it won't be 4:32. We can't put Paul to work right in the middle of the show. Maybe what we should do is do an album of the show later on at the end of the year. The
greatest hits of the Paul English show.
4:32 B-mix, greatest hits throughout the year. And we'll start doing it. We can sell it for sixpence and then we can get sued by somebody.
Oh, yeah. That'll put us on the radar right quick. Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. Wow. That. Anyway, the Hudson book. I'm very keen. I can't wait to start reading it. The problem is, I've mentioned this before. When I start reading, I start buying more and more books because of the footnotes. I just ordered one today on the Peasants' Revolt of 1381 because I needed a more detailed stuff. I've got some information on that, actually, or a little poem about that to read, or parts of it later on in the show. Actually, it's a fantastic thing. And So I'll buy one thing. I don't know if you do this, but I buy one thing. I see a footnote of this bit, and it sparks an idea off. I go and check another one.
Yeah, I do that too.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah.
I'm tripping over books all over the place that I can't get read. I've got bookmarks in them all over.
Me too. I've got bookmarks all over, and then it's just like I pick up one, and then I'll pick up another, and it's just like you become ADD after a while.
Yeah.
It's hard to concentrate.
It is. It is. It's like overwhelm. It's being, you know, totally overwhelmed. I want to read a bit more out of this little Hudson blurb. I put the link, by the way. Anybody wants to see it, I put the link in the chat over at Rumbledon. Rumbledon. It's like Wimbledon.
We need more readers. We need more people reading. You know, many hands make light work, and then you can just get people up to speed real quick if you know it.
Yeah, absolutely. We're not talking to your audience right now. Don't go off and start reading things now. We don't want that. We want you to stay here. Read afterwards. But look, there's a bit more that's worth reading out from this blurb. Seriously.
It's like Dr. Johnson and his dictionary. He's got all these other people looking up the word definitions for him and then compiling them all together. We need a structure like that, like a university.
Hey, that's a good idea. Somebody should do that one day. That would be quite good. How about this? He writes, the big economic question is, and has always been, what will happen if debts cannot be paid? Will there be a debt write-down in favor of debtors, as has been done for large corporations? Oh, yeah, they get that, don't they? Or will creditors be allowed to foreclose, as is always done on personal debtors and mortgage holders, leading to their political takeover of the assets of the economy and the government's public sector? Good question, Michael. Yes. So let's see. The banks get bailed out, but we don't. I know I'm only preaching to the converted and singing to the choir, but it's quite fun, isn't it, every now and again? So the banks, they get bailed out, but we don't. That seems to be the way it works. Is that right? Yes. He says, and he goes on, he says, the problem of debt backlogs, this won't be new to anybody, was created with the invention of interest-bearing loans, i.e. usurious loans, i.e. the arrival of the usury industry. In agrarian 3rd millennium BC Mesopotamia, I knew it was the bloody Mesopotamians, they've got a lot to answer for. Are they still around? The remedy of record, he says here, was the royal clean state proclamation, or jubilee year of debt forgiveness. And they had these jubilee years had three functions. They restored, and we want all of these things, right? So you see, it's completely relevant. And I haven't even read them yet, and I know we want them. One, they restored financial balance by annulling the backlog of crop debts that had accrued. Two, they liberated indebted bond servants, that's you and me, everyone, okay, and their families. And three, they restored land tenure rights, enabling debtors to continue living productively on the land, pay taxes, and be available for military service and corvée labour. What does corvée mean? Anybody know what that means? I don't know what it means. C-O-R-V-E, with an accent over E. What's corvée or corvée?
Move? That'd be my guess, to move labor from one place to another.
Okay. Mobile labor. All right, maybe it does.
That's a guess.
Yeah, no, maybe you're right. Anyway, it looks like a cracking sort of thing, does that. If he's got stuff on, I mean, I've come across a podcast about a history podcast on Byzantium. It's excellent, really good. I was out for a walk the other day listening to it. Some English guy, tremendously well researched and put together. Because, you know, why is it not taught? Ezra Pound, whose face should actually go on the pound, and if you think it's a bit odd that an American should go on a British pound, no, it's not, because he spent a lot of time in England, and he understood absolutely the nature of the banking system better than anybody, because he's the guy that basically charged Mullins to go off and do the whole book, the first real big book on the Federal Reserve. But it was through Pound that this Byzantium policy was discovered. That's what I know. Maybe somebody else found it, but Pound found that they barred aliens from occupying any positions of power in government, banking, education, and the law. And that's why he suggested it lasted 1,200 years or whatever it is. And I think that there's probably a great deal to do with it. In other words, the Byzantians are basically a living example that diversity is not anybody's strength. It's a complete menace to everybody. And stability is based on a complete lack of diversity, which is what we're all very interested in.
there was also a symbiotic relationship between church and state as well that existed in the Byzantine Empire that doesn't exist anymore and hasn't since really the Bourbon monarch had his head chopped off. It's not, I mean, maybe it does in some heretical way. But
when did the Bourbon monarch get his head chopped off? Do you know when that was?
French Revolution, was it 1893 or somewhere around there?
Yeah, yeah.
Sometime around there.
It's interesting that you're mentioning, that you're mentioning the French, because corvée is French. Yeah. It's a form of unpaid forced labor that is intermittent in nature, lasting for a limited periods of time, typically only a certain number of days work each year, where statute labor is a corvée imposed by a state for the purposes of public works. As such, it represents a form of levy or taxation. Unlike other forms of levy, such as tithe, the corvée does not require the population to have land, crops, or cash. The obligation for tenant farmers to perform corvée work for landlords on private landed estates was widespread throughout history before the Industrial Revolution, the term most typically used in reference to medieval and early modern Europe, where work was often expected by a feudal landowner of their vassals or by a monarch of their subjects.
Wow. Can you read that again? No, I don't mean right now. That was really good.
Where'd you read that from? Was that like Black's Law?
Where'd you get that from, Paul?
Wikipedia.
Oh, boy. Well,
hey, there's a short
take it
version
with a grain of salt.
So Avatarin has put a little shorter version here. Corvée is a form of unpaid forced labor. There, now I got that. Unpaid forced labor that is intermittent in nature, so you have to go back and do it every now and again, I suppose, lasting for limited periods of time, typically only a certain number of days' work each year. Statute labor is a corvée imposée, or imposed. Wow. Unpaid and forced.
Would that be like conscription? So, in military sense?
I guess it is.
Maybe put
into
the
labor pay you
force?
When they're in the military, though? They do pay you.
Yeah, they do pay you.
Yeah, but you might die.
Yeah, probably not what it's worth, a pittance of what it's worth, just to keep
you. No, you might die. Okay, we just gone past the halfway mark here, so I'm gonna play this song, and then you can guess the name of the band afterwards. You'll probably guess it halfway through. You're here listening to Paul English Live on WBN 324. We're halfway through. I'm here with Paul. Yeah, another one, very confusing, and Patrick. So everybody in here is it's the three P's at the moment. There we go. Let's have a song. And we'll join you. We'll be back in about 3 or 4 minutes. Here we go. Except, of course, there we go.
You hit the wrong button.
No, I didn't. It's coming. Can you hear it coming?
There it is.
Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, now Constantinople, been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's church delight on a moonlit night. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, now Constantinople. So if you've a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul. Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say.
People just liked it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone, Constantinople. Why did Constantinople get the works? That's nobody's business but the Turks. Istanbul.
Istanbul.
Istanbul. Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say.
People just liked it better that way.
Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, now Constantinople. Been a long time gone, Constantinople. Why did Constantinople get the works? That's nobody's business but the Turks.
Thank you. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the works? That's nobody's business but the Turks. Istanbul.
Attention all listeners, are you seeking uninterrupted access to WBN 324 Talk Radio despite incoming censorship hurdles? Well, it's a breeze. Just grab and download Opera Browser, then type in WBN324.zil and stay tuned for unfiltered discussions around the clock. That's WBN324.zil.
The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on the World Broadcasting Network are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of its owners, partners and other hosts or this network. Thank you for listening to WBN 324 Talk Radio.
And welcome back to part two. I'm here with Patrick and Paul. So Paul, Patrick, Paul, welcome back. And the song, there you go. What was the name of the band?
They Might Be Giants.
They might be. Absolutely. Yes, it. 10 points. Toffees to you too as well. Thanks very much for throwing that in. I was so glad. I used to listen to that loads. I don't know what year it is. It used to just come up a lot. A friend's house. He used to play it non-stop. And someone wrote, the music's funny. It is, but it's very apt considering that we were talking about Constantinople. So there you go. We're nothing if not
It was
relevant.
Written in 1953. It was the 500th anniversary of the fall of Constantinople.
Was it?
It's written by Jimmy Kennedy. Yeah. And the four lads, they were the first to do it. To perform it. Yeah. So have a listen to that on when you can.
No, we might. Is that the one that Paul sent over? Have you sent over the four lads version? Okay. Yeah. We'll do that later. Maybe it's just an Istanbul night. I'll have to retitle the show or something. We've all gone crazy and carried away. So wonderful. Actually, there's a question in here a little bit earlier from Night and Day. Said, to the best of your knowledge, this is to all of us, right? How far back in years can we go with recorded evidence of debt forgiveness, if such a thing really exists?
Hammurabi. I think he makes the case that Hammurabi did.
Yeah? What are we talking there? 600-700 BC? Or is it more recent than that?
Code of Hammurabi?
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see it. It will be interesting to check that through.
It'd be 1755 BC. Quite a ways away, almost 4,000 years ago.
We're going to have to work hard on this one, lads. Now, does everybody remember the Jubilee year? No.
Yeah, wasn't that what the Jubilee was all about?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm really
been
on
around
for
forever. It's just they forgot about it. They forgot about it because they were so greedy. They didn't want to forgive anybody's debts. They just said, the the global monetary system is going to melt down eventually anyways. Why not we make them a bunch of shekels in the meanwhile?
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
You're so cynical, Paul. I mean, you know, maybe it was just an honest mistake that they made. And, you know, they were just thinking it was the best. You know? Well, who's going to pay the creditors? You know. Have you seen this?
Usually there were wars to settle the debt. You know, if they didn't want to do it, then they'd have a big old war, and then finally someone would have to beg for mercy, and they'd have to have mercy on them.
Yeah.
But modern wars are kind of merciless. It's not something that you really talk about. It's easy just to ignore them because they're distant, usually. They're not here anymore, you know. Mm-hmm. World War II was the last time any of us really had to deal with it in our cultures.
I know. Well, and then Civil War here. They use fictional... They use fictional paper. They use debt instruments, promissory notes. Mm-hmm. And I had a question in another conference from earlier today. I had a question. You know, if the government is so bad, and they don't want us to have energy independence, why do they subsidize people putting solar arrays and off-grid power systems in their homes? Well, they don't subsidize it, first of all, because you've got an agreement that you sign when you purchase a solar system for your house. And your signature on that, which is essentially a promissory note, gets monetized And the government pays for your solar system using the very paper you created. They didn't put anything into it. And then they give you 25% on the dollar or 50 cents on the dollar as a payback on this solar system that you got. So you would be grid independent. But then the system is set up grid tied, so it gets its pilot signal from the grid. So if the grid goes down, so does your solar system. You've got fully charged batteries. You've got buku solar panels on the roof, but yet you have no power because the grid isn't there. They shut you off. They do nothing for you. They give you nothing. You enable them to make money. And what did they do? They took $20,000 or $25,000 that you created and they put it back into the economy and bolstered the economy. They put a few people to work. They made some tax money. The whole thing is just way too crazy.
You seem a bit cynical about government, Paul. I'm a bit shocked, frankly.
I'm sorry.
Well, I know as a Catholic,
I get that way on Thursdays.
As a Catholic, I learned about the Jubilee year. The most recent one in the church was during the millennium transition from 99 to 2000.
Was it?
I remember they have a special ceremony they do where certain churches, cathedral churches, they have a door called the Jubilee door where they open that only during the Jubilee every 50 years.
Yeah.
And it's a special ceremony. It goes back, you know, for as long as the church has been around. So I'm picking up some background audio noise.
Is Paul having a party in his flat? Is that a party, Paul? What's going on? He's having a party. Maybe that was I didn't know that at all, Patrick. That's really
Yeah, I was in Rome actually at St. Peter's during the whole Jubilee where they were opening the doors to the cathedrals and basilicas, and they would they have a special door. You go to Italy and most any Catholic cathedral, they'll have a special door usually, and they'll keep it closed except during that Jubilee year that they'll open it, and then once the Jubilee year is done, they close it. And I wonder what that has to, what the history of that is, actually, like going back to, say, medieval times, feudal times, Byzantine times, what the significance of that would be. Like, did they keep stock, or how did that work? But, that was the last one. And you then shortly after that, that's when we had the whole September 11th thing, 2001, which was the year after that, which, you know, might have been the powers that be saying, nope, we don't want to have a Jubilee. Here's what we'll do to you if you don't pay up.
This permanent conflict, as it were, between the rulers and the ruled, it's human nature never changes, does it? It's quite, this aspect of it doesn't. They become ensconced in a worldview that we can't, it's not possible for us to shake that worldview out of their heads. I'm talking about the rulers here. That it seems to come in cycles. I mean, all of this high-tech CBDC stuff that that we'll continue to talk about, because it's obviously going to be a theme for several years yet until they've hopefully not got us under the cosh with it. But it's about creating, you've all heard this as well, sort of high-tech neo-feudalism. That's really what they're seeking to recreate, is it not? What do you think?
It's kind of an intransigence of not wanting to bend. You know, you pay us what you owe us, and we're not going to give you any sort of slack. You know, you're our servant. It's that mentality of enslaving people because you deserve their labor. You know, they're not in control. You're the hub. You know, that's the group, the bankers that are in control are kind of the hub, and everybody else is a node in the hub, you know, being controlled by the hub. It's just a two different systems, two different, you know, so to speak, races going on. Like, the literal word for race is you have a goal that you're trying to achieve, and it's a competition to see who gets there first. But if you don't have the same goal, then you're running a different race. And I think that's what's going on. You have one group here running their race and the other running their race. And they try to confuse matters by getting you to believe that, hey, you're playing by our game rules. When we should be having our own race.
Yes. Well, we should. And I think actually conversations like this and what's been going on over the past few years is part of that process of us rediscovering that we do have our own path and we have to get back on it, because there's no way we can get them to change the path down which they seek to go and drag us to. I mean, they're not going to change. Like I said, you know, I'm very keen to get hold of this book by Michael Hudson, and it will be very useful to me, and it will energize me, I'm pretty sure, just having read the blurb, and to get to grips with some of these things, which I currently don't know. I love it when I come across stuff that I'm not aware of, and there's a lot of that. So that's going to be helpful. Yet the proviso that I have running also in the back of my head is that very point that there have been and there currently exist in the world systems of reorganizing the economy, which from our point of view, from our race, as it were, the race that we want to run, are way, way better than this system that we are encumbered with, that we are compelled to use because of their control of courts, their centuries, if not millennia old, deceptions that they've written into the law to get people confused. The idea of being born almost as a bondservant. I know that this is what Roger, who has been suffering the power outages that Paul was referring to, that's what he's talking about, and he's right to talk about it because it's correct to look at that. I read that poem out by Kipling. I'm not going to read the whole of this out. This is huge. If I read this out, maybe I should record it, even though there's an English guy who has recorded it. And I've mentioned it here on the show before. It's called The Red Dagger by Heathcote Williams. And this also taps into this book I'm about to receive about the Peasants' Revolt, because that's really what this poem is about. But I'm just going to read a couple, two or three verses from it, just to give you a feel for it, because it's relevant to what we're talking about. And it's also really rather wonderful as well. Here we go. He begins as follows. London's symbol for the hub of global finance in the city, shown on the city's flag to convey heraldic grandeur, comes from a blood-soaked dagger that killed the rebel Wat Tyler, for Tyler had challenged London on behalf of the poor. The dagger survives and is on display in Fishmonger's Hall, in the city's secretive mini-state within a state. And, like a trophy, its red silhouette is on the city's coat of arms, as if Tyler's murder was something to celebrate. But the 100,000 marching on London in 1381 were serfs objecting to being kept as virtual slaves by the feudal equivalent of corporate power, whereby people were caught and taxed to death just for being alive. 100,000 of those on whose exploitation the wealth of a feudal society depended, from ploughmen to carpenters to cowmen to sheep shearers, trapped by a bondage that only death ended. So their spokesman, Wat Tyler, demanded equality. All men should be free and of one condition. We will be free forever, our heirs and our lands. But instead of sympathy, he aroused suspicion. Wat Tyler would rock England's power elite to the core through his opposition to the Statute of Labourers, a law which kept free-born Englishmen tied to landlords whom Tyler exposed as procurers and plunderers. And I could go on because I think it's really rather one of the most marvellous things I've ever read, actually. But it's that gives you a flavour. And I've said that what we actually, one of the things I've thought about for now is that we are in need of Peasants' Revolt 2.0, and we're all Wat Tyler now, or we need to become Wat Tyler, because it's an astonishing fight back, and the rest of the poem is kind of a prose poem in a way, isn't it? Goes through what he and these, so this is serious times, 1381, and Paul, you remember last week I was talking about that book, Who Owns England, by Guy Shrubsole. There's a section in there where there was an event happened in 1377, I think. It's about 4 years before the Peasants' Revolt, which was instrumental in kicking this off. Because they'd had the Black Death, and there were only about half the amount of men or labourers in England to work the same bits of land. And they were being basically worked to death. And that attitude, even though the form's different, that attitude between the owners and the owned, because that's how they view it, has not died, regrettably. And we're kind of living in all the turmoil of that to this day. Right now, these very times are sort of, you know, redolent with it.
Right. Mm. I do believe that I found that. I think that I found that last week. I went and got it.
What, the Red Dagger?
No, Who Owns England?
Oh, right. You got a... Oh, right. Oh, you mean the one by John Bateman? The one in archives? Yes?
Yes. But there's also... I'm looking. I'm digging around. I'm still trying to find the Red Dagger.
I don't know.
This is what I do. Yeah, you talk about cool stuff, and I just sit here feverishly typing on my keyboard with my mic muted. So, you know, hunting for all this stuff.
No, that's cool. That's great, Paul. It's fantastic. I mean, there are things later on in this prose poem. I'm trying to just find a section where it's the landowners. Of course, he's going to express it way better than I am because it's a thoughtful expression. I wish I could find it. They basically, it started at Fobbing, right, in Essex. So shout out to you there, Eric, in your neck of the woods. It all kicked off at Fobbing. And there's a phrase in English now. Basically, they were sending out tax collectors to, he uses this thing to find out about their impudent lack of respect or something for the taxes. What's going on with all the plebs, basically? So they send all these thugs out. They get their ass kicked. And this happened in a town, a little village called Fobbing. And in the English language over here, fobbing someone off is to put off payment. They're fobbed off. And it's come to mean a lot more than just that now. But, yeah, he's fobbing you off means, you know, he's telling you a porky pie, a lie, to delay the payment or whatever, you know. It says here, in the village of Fobbing, the tax collector was met by the inhabitants brandishing longbows and axes. The people of Fobbing would only pay him with arrows instead of their coins of the realm for royal taxes. It's quite a thing. There's a thing as well called a muniments room in all these castles which they would go to, which kept all the deeds of their enslavement in the muniments room, and they would get and burn these things. This is serious. I mean, it's 100,000. The population of England at the time was about 3 million. So 100,000 is a lot. It's huge. It's absolutely enormous. I mean, of course, everybody was working on the land unless you were lord this, that, and the other. But it's such a vivid account of something. And I'm hoping to, you know, I've got something else on the way to read it in sort of long form version and to really get to grips with it. Marxists and communists have jumped all over this saying, you know, blah, blah. Well, of course, it's complete rot. It's got nothing to do with that. We're not interested in your nonsense. It's to do with peasants basically being abused in such a way. So,
Well, a lot of that gets passed off as communism, too, to a certain extent.
Yes.
And by the West, you know, by the bankers here, they like to use that term communism to go after their enemies. Because it's been demonized so much, so usefully.
Yes.
Just like in Latin America.
But they are communists.
Yeah, well, yeah. Wizard of Oz, don't pay attention to the man behind the curtain. You know, they put up the curtain of capitalism to hide their communism.
It's classic narcissism. Demonize that which they are guilty of and then accuse somebody else of it.
Mm-hmm.
Narcissism. Oh, and the warehouse receipt, the birth certificate, they do that in America, too. When the certificate of live birth, when the birth is registered by the hospital, that generates the birth certificate, which is used as a warehouse receipt. And that warehouse receipt gets stored in a safe under 24/7 armed guards. It's exactly the same thing.
The serfs of
old...
That's a system that supplanted the church, which used to baptize infants into the church, and then you would thus become a member of the church.
Right.
Whereas nowadays, it's all about
church.
Well, yeah, in a sense, property of God, you know, returning to God's dominion. But Yeah, and in a way, they've perverted that and secularized it, whatever you want to call it, and made it into birth certificates, and it's the whole medical industry, military complex, of just getting everybody into the system that alienates us from our God-given rights and our God-given
yes
freedom.
Yeah. Very much. I mean, this is not a new battle.
Right.
Obviously, it's not a new battle. It's biblical, which I've always said, and which anybody can say, and if you say that, you're speaking the truth, because it is. It's ancient, is this. There's a few books on this Red Dagger page. There's a few books that it takes some quotes from before the prose poem begins. These are worth reading, actually. Now, the book, this is from Alistair Dunn, The Peasant's Revolt. This is the book I've just ordered earlier today, actually, so that should be fun. He writes, Wat Tyler, John Ball. Now, John Ball is the mendicant priest. What a guy. I mean, I probably need to. We might keep
John
coming back
Ball?
To this. John Ball, B-A-L-L. He was a priest. He was kicked out of every single church, and the people loved him, and he would preach wherever he was stood and gather a crowd almost instantaneously. They all met a very bad end, these people, because of this. But so it shows you their ferocious courage, which was considerable. But he writes, Dunn's little quote is, Wat Tyler, John Ball, and the leaders of the county risings were the first ordinary men in the British Isles to mount a credible attack on the political and economic structures of their day. It's a major event because it really is a genuine. There aren't many in recent times genuine uprisings of people. They're all been orchestrated by the lords.
Now, this is
them.
The Peasants' Revolt. When was this? This was 13, after the Protestant.
1381. No.
13?
Yeah. 1381. Yeah.
Oh,
long
okay.
time back.
Yeah.
It was after the Black Death. So he said, attack on the political and economic structures of their day. The rebels of 1381 succeeded in giving a voice to those who had hitherto lacked any means of expressing their common political grievances. We've got the means of expressing them, courtesy of this technology, but now we are systematically not listened to, whilst they pretend to listen to us. There is no dialogue taking place. So that was that. Then there's another one from a book called The Conquest of Bread by Peter Kropotkin. Now, this must be old from the writing style, but I wouldn't mind getting a copy of this. It says, weary shame on the feudal baron who forbade the peasant to turn a clod of earth unless he surrendered to his lord a fourth of his crop. We call those the barbarous times. But if the forms have changed, the relations have remained the same, and the worker is forced, under the name of free contract, under the name of free contract, to accept feudal obligations. For, turn where he will, he can find no better conditions. Everything has become private property, and he must accept or die of hunger. That's interesting. And here's one from Tolstoy, Leo Tolstoy, the guy that wrote War and Peace. Obviously not relevant to this, but it is relevant, but not specifically focused. And very brief. At the foundation of every great fortune lies a great crime. And under this quote, in brackets, it says, referring to the ownership of common land as robbery. So this thing about the land and the commons and land in common, I think I might have mentioned last week that forest, the word forest, we think of it, obviously, I could be wrong about this, but certainly the implication from the book was that the word forest, we think of it obviously as this large gathering of trees and shrubs and so on and so forth, because that's what it is.
The woods.
Yeah, the woods, the large woods. But when William the Conqueror came here, he was very keen on hunting wild boar, and forest became the word for these private estates that the king seized so he could hunt boar with his pals. This went on for hundreds of years, of course. In fact, the last wild boar was killed in England sometime in the 1700s, Patrick. So there's no wild boar killing for you, I'm afraid, to do over here. You couldn't do that over here. So they lasted longer than I would have thought. But that's how they began to seize all the land. And commoners who had been farming the commons, if they were found on this land, would be killed. They'd be hung. That's how much they thought of people. This is like two different species. It is two different races. There's a lack of consideration and care. These are supposedly Christian kings. I think not.
It was after the Magna Carta that took place then. And it's kind of maybe a way to haul back on the ground made from the Magna Carta? I don't
know.
No,
I've got to read a lot more about it. But it's an amazing piece of period of history. Again, not taught much, if at all. Now, I suppose not taught at all in schools, and yet I'm not aware of a genuine people's uprising like this. I mean, there've got to be them. There have been them, but in English history, this is real. This really happened on the ground. People just got hacked off. And, of course, you look at the situation. They're not being monitored by telephone calls and mobile phones or anything like that. They're all strong. Those that were alive would have been strong. They're workers on the land. They would have had physical fortitude of a type that we don't have, right? They would have been wiry. They might not have been 6'4". They might have been 5'4". But they had it's not the size of dog. It's the amount of, you know, it's not the size of the dog in the fight. It's the amount of fight in the dog. And they would have had a lot in them. And there's a wonderful heroine as well in it called Joanna Faroor, who was an archer, ladies, and she shot these tax collectors to death with her bow and arrow. It's just fantastic, and I'm going, hey, this seems so healthy. What a great way to express yourself and get back at them. It's quite a thing. It's an amazing story.
It kind of reminds me of what Michael Hudson talks about was happening in Latin America as a consequence of their World Bank loans that they were granted. They would basically get into debt, into usury debt of 40% or greater loans that would be paid to the rich in the country and to Wall Street.
Yep.
And as a consequence, they would constantly have to export the goods that they created and then buy dollars, U.S. dollars, in exchange for buying bread or corn or wheat from North America,
yes,
from the U.S. farmers. And there were ways that the Catholic Church was getting around it, and it was demonized by the CIA as this thing called liberation theology, where essentially it was demonizing what the church was doing down there with the missionaries and the priests and nuns. Yep. Where they were going to the farmers and they were saying, hey, farmers, trade amongst yourselves. You don't need to deal with the U.S. dollars. And plant wheat, plant corn. Here's how you do it. Here's how you start a farm and keep it going.
Yep.
And the CIA and the U.S. military didn't like that, so they would send military guys down there to start wars, guerrilla warfare amongst them, and just go and kill these priests and nuns. And there was one martyr, Oscar Romero, which, you know, it was now Saint Oscar Romero, but they were basically saying, hey, you're going to starve to death under these conditions. You need to farm for yourselves and create a barter. And they were doing this, but they were also getting these guerrillas hired by the CIA to go down there, and they'd have assassination squads going to the farms and killing farmers and these priests and nuns that were teaching them how to do it, how to have a sustainable economy without using the U.S. dollar.
Well, that's the direction that we got to move in, don't you think? I meet up with people, I've mentioned it here before, in real
without
life at
fear.
The pub every couple of weeks. And we went to a different pub this week. It was great. I had a pretty good steak. Anyway, it's like a little mini farm market, slowly growing. I pick up my eggs there. I got 3 dozen eggs, which come direct from a farm, and we have to reconnect with all the farms. We've got to do that. What you've just outlined is exactly one of the things that we've got to start including in our behavior and building it back up again, because I don't see what else we're going to do. And I want to go direct to the farms, and a union between the consumer and the farmer, direct, cutting out the middleman, will do so much, because it creates these community spaces in which the communication has to take place. So you're meeting up with people of like mind and creating solidarity and a sense of encouragement, literally.
And you'll have better digestion.
Yes, and better eggs
too.
And better eggs. Everything's going to be better. So I've been instructed not to throw away my egg cartons, which I don't now, because they're going back to this farm, because the one thing they can't produce is egg cartons. So they're going to have them for, you know, shifting more eggs to people as the circuit builds up. And it's wonderful. It makes me feel good. And they're no more expensive than in the supermarket. In fact, the prices that they're doing in the supermarket, the egg producers are getting practically nothing, and yet the supermarkets are still keeping the prices up at that level. These things, these little nibble actions, even if you may think that they're not going to produce too much in the short term, although you never can tell with stuff like this, I think they're very good for you as an individual. They encourage you. They do me. They do me very much. I've just come across, Patrick, another six verses here from this poem, and I want to read them because they're so good. It's still tapping into this thing. This is jumping ahead a bit. It says, and I've mentioned a couple of these things in the last 10 minutes, but it's worth just reading them as they were laid down in the poem. It says, since the Black Death, so that's pre-1381, the population had been halved, and so the workforce began deserting its feudal cage. But an upper and middle class parliament felt threatened by their agricultural slaves demanding a living wage. The peasants, or villeins, which, you know, are people that live in villages, villeins, this cruel statute declared, do menace their lords in life and member, and gather themselves in great routs, and agree by such confederacy that one should aid the other. Ooh, that's us then. I agree by such confederacy that we should aid one another by going direct to the farms, for example. Therefore, it goes on, labourers were forbidden to withdraw their labour or even to discuss their conditions. Combining together to ask for better wages was now illegal, and if you escaped your feudal lord, you faced prison. In his poem, Piers Plowman, the poet William Langland depicted life for manual workers who were landless. They cursed the king and all the king's justices for making laws to grieve labourers. They'd no rest. On May the 30th, 1381, an insurrection was kindled in Brentwood. This is where it kicked off then. Not Fobbing, but Fobbing's part of it, I think. May 30th, 1381. Oh, it'll be May the 30th soon, won't it? Essex villages were refusing to make poll tax returns. So royal poll tax commissioners, backed by soldiers, were sent to inquire after their subjects' impudent lack of concern. I love that line, it's fantastic. The unexpected result was that royal clerks and soldiers were ejected from half a dozen villages as hundreds of poll tax defaulters bonded together to fight what they regarded as state-sanctioned pillage. England's villagers were tired of working morning till night for the benefit of the lord of the manor, unable to buy or sell, move or marry, or grind their own corn, without fines and fees and permission from the master. Yeah. So it's quite
the malevolent
vivid.
Master.
The malevolent masters. Yes. And Tyler must have had the courage of a lion, because there's a bit later on where he actually meets with the king. And he's just completely not fazed by the king. Much to the chagrin of the mayor of London, who was absolutely seething and going out of his mind with it, apparently. Because
Oh, go ahead.
No, he's just so impudent. By the way, the mayor of London was running a brothel in the Houses of Parliament, just to let you know, at the time.
Wait, this is still the peasant revolt you're talking about?
Yeah, this is still the peasant's revolt. Or wherever the meeting place was for Parliament at the time, he was running a brothel. Yeah. I don't know whether this is in the poem or not, but yeah, these are wretched people. They really are.
Well, and it seems like the church has also had a less important role as time's gone on, but it used to be that they would have holy days where you would have time off to celebrate a feast day or to celebrate some martyr's day, and you would have time off of work. The people worked less hours and had more time of leisure and time for devotion.
Yes.
That's where I assume we get the word holiday, which is holy day, with a I instead of a Y. So it's something that we lack today. Like if you're working for the government or you're working for just anyone here as an employer, you get very few actual holidays,
yes,
of paid time off or time to just go off and have leisure time to do your household work or whatever it might be. Even to this day, it's becoming less and less important. Yep. And you're working more and more hours and making less and less money as a consequence too, because you don't know how to use leisure time to put yourself in a better position.
Yes.
And that's what's lacking. We're all men of action, but not leisure. And like Aristotle said, you need that priestly class is dependent on the leisure so they can understand how things work. So you're not wasting your effort when you're working.
Yes.
And most people, they don't even get to think about it. They're just little drones in a factory somewhere doing the same thing over and over again without knowing what they're doing. And you can be like a Henry Ford and have an assembly line and everybody has a purpose, but you need a bigger grasp of what the totality is in order to appreciate your work. And I think that's missing. Needs to be found again.
It is, although in defense of Ford, he did design his factory so that his workers could actually buy one of the cars that they made, didn't he? So I mean, this is all part of the process. I'm not for mass production of things, but that was the period that they went through at that particular time, obviously. But everything you said about the idea of digestion time, an idea of leisure time to digest ideas and to consider them more fully and to not be rushed. I mean, you know, I was saying earlier this thing about like ADHD, about buying books and stuff. It is a bit mad. And of course, when you look at some of the technology that we've got in our hands on the phone, like Telegram in particular, it's just a flood of stuff. And it's very difficult at times for me to want to pull away, because most of it is so relevant. There's so many articulate people pulling good things up. But it does consume time and take away from thoughtful pipe smoking time in the garden. You know, those sorts of moments, most people don't have them anymore. They don't seem to exist, do they? And you mentioning about this hecticness with the economy, another thing that I've said before, we'll keep saying these things again. If we go back to when I was, you know, in the 50s and 60s in the UK, it would definitely been the case in the States. The husband could go out and work and the woman could raise the children at home and they lived well. They didn't have too much debt because they weren't allowed to get debt. There were no credit cards. The food was much more direct from the local farms. It was where I grew up. It would come into the local butchers and greengrocers. It was only a few miles away. My dad knew where the farms were, where the food was coming from, because he was in the food industry to some degree. And all these things just added up to make things simpler, more direct. And you had a much stronger bonding of a local community because of all these factors, which have all been systematically broken down to be replaced by centralized, systemized control, which is dull as ditch water. It's what they want. Because they're running around, I guess, in fear of us or something. Maybe they don't know in fear at all. They just want us to think that. But there's definitely a parting of the ways. We've got.
I think they fear. Yeah, I think they do fear the common man. Mm-hmm. That if he did understand what has been done to him, he would rise up against it. And it's just the man's work would be close to home. He wouldn't be commuting 3 hours away, 2 hours away to some city in order to make a living to support both him and his wife without the wife having to go to work. Because that's another thing, is this idea that you have to go far away from your home in order to make a decent wage is ridiculous as well.
It is.
And it breaks families up. Same with the education system, the government schools are basically raising your children as orphans. Mm-hmm. You give them up as orphans to the state to run them and to indoctrinate them with false doctrine.
Yeah.
That is not conducive to a family life. And then they end up doing radical things to themselves, to go off to university and learn Marxism and all the other stuff that goes with it. The cultural crap. And
yeah, well, it wasn't good. Different for the parents. Excuse me, I'm sorry. It wasn't just different for the parents. It was different for the children as well. Because in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, how many people listening to this program remember the Meccano magazine? M-E-C-C-A-N-O magazine.
Meccano,
it was a magazine.
We say Meccano over here, but Meccano, right? Okay, Meccano. We know what we're talking about. Yeah.
Okay, and the 20s, the 30s, and the 40s. But that was a magazine for construction projects and toys for kids.
Yeah.
Okay, and children. You know, not baby goats. Children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in there, they had the original Erector set. It taught young lads and girls engineering and structures. They had model airplanes that actually had to be assembled, and you knew you got it right if it flew. You were learning aerial technology, aeronautics. The way the children played was preparing them to enter the workplace with a very, very marketable skill. Mm-hmm. It was playing. Now it's Beanie Babies and Candy Crush on their phone. And if their battery goes dead, well, the world is coming to an end.
Stand by.
Mommy, I can't play Candy Crush. My charger broke. I'm going to hold my breath.
We've got to get you to play that role.
Can I use your phone?
That's very good, Paul.
It's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, we used to teach the children how to think. Mm-hmm. We don't teach the children how to think. Of course, they're going to be idiots when they make their 20s. We certainly don't teach them anything of value in the public indoctrination system. School system.
Yes. Well, I guess
we've got a lot of 180 degree turns back to. I'm sorry. I hate it when I get on my soapbox, but you pushed my hot button.
I love it. No, it's right on there. It's really right in there because maybe the only question they've got to ask is, should I go to school? And the answer is no. Don't go. It's pointless. It's completely
exactly.
But you see, if they're not intelligent enough to even ask that question, they're going to go into that space and then they're going to get lost because they come out without this ability to question with a good heart. There's a quality, there's a kind of attitudinal quality in a person that's asking questions honorably. There's a way to ask questions honorably and soundly in such a way that the answer is bound to come to you if you ask them in the right spirit. But if you look at, say, what passes for communication in the political sphere, where they're all saying they're asking questions, they're not. They all know the answers. They're just setups for punchlines and all this other sort of manipulation in the communication. It's a joke. It's why they're so sort of retarded. And yet they can't see that they lack wisdom either. They just can't, because, look, I'm very clever. Yeah, you're clever, but you are not wise.
So they can wear a mask and shoot up. That's what it teaches them.
It does.
You know, just wear your mask 6 feet apart. Put the needle in your arm.
Are those the lyrics to a song?
Yeah, I think it's Neil Young's song, Needle in the Damage Done.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Night and Day writes here in the chat. I'm just going to read this out. It says, the art of barter will almost certainly return if the powers that be forces down the CBDC route. Your thoughts, guys? What do you think, Paul? The art of barter.
I think so.
Yeah.
Barter and trade.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in the public, you engage in commerce. But if you're in private, you engage in trade.
Stop paying attention to the media, the CBS, mm-hmm. AB, the three-letter media. Mockingbird Media.
Mm-hmm.
Just turn that stuff off. Don't ignore it. Just leave it alone. You don't need that messing with your brain, and you know you end up contemplating the things you listen to. So turn that off. Open up a book.
Yep.
Buy a Michael Hudson book. Buy any book, you know, for that matter, from people who actually think about how to get out of this whole system of control and mind manipulation.
Don't you find, Patrick, power, that just conversations like this and being part of them every now and again, I find it anyway, it provides all that bedrock of motivation to keep ploughing on with things. It's massively important to know that without other people, all of this is completely pointless, which is why families are the most important thing. Because they are the most important thing. It's not even debatable. Without families and no children, there's no point us all being clever. There's going to be nobody around to carry anything on. It just gets crushed. And, of course, we see nearly all of the things that we've been talking about the last 10 minutes, you know, from working and this, are all designed incrementally to destroy families. Even this encouragement, you know, to move away from home. I mean, even if it wasn't for economic reasons, certainly in the 60s and 70s, it was to go to London because it's much more glamorous and interesting. Actually, in my case, this is true. It actually was where I came from at the time. But you've you often don't see the treasure on your own doorstep when you're growing up. You kind of miss it because, you know, you get bedazzled by other things, which is quite exciting. And
and there's something to be said of a pilgrimage. You know, like you have the famous English author Chaucer, and he talked about a pilgrimage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a way to go see what the world is like and have respect for what you're looking at. And then come back, and you'll have that much more knowledge of how things actually work.
You do.
So, and to have that sense of adventure and journey, you know, go off and find out what the world's like, but then come back and realize you have a family that care about you. And that's the thing. That everybody's got this pressure. Oh, you got to go and have a career. You got to think about your education. And it's just like, you need to have a family support structure, because that is your bank of sorts, you know, that you can rely on it when you reach troubled times. And it's okay to be poor and not have to have the material goods there to always satisfy your every craving, and be able to think and have skills that you can build on, like farming. Farming's a perfect example. You learn how to raise animals. You learn how to keep vegetation because you mm-hmm. have to feed the animals.
Yeah.
And then learn what products you can use in your day-to-day life. Milk and eggs, meat. It all goes together. And support people who are doing the same thing you're trying to do. And trade with them. Because they might have something that you need, and you might have something they need. Learn how to think. They don't teach proper in these government schools. They don't want you to learn how to manage your wealth. They want you to rely on somebody else and be a debt slave to them. Go into further education, further debt.
It's all so subtle, isn't it? But there's so many hundreds of nibbles at us. And I guess the glue that they've used that's worked perfectly is TV has held everything together, because it sets the tone, unbeknownst to you, for what your expectations in life are expected to be. This is the sort of thing you should be thinking about. And it draws people into supposedly advanced education. I mean, when I left school in 78, by gum, I never wanted to go to university, and I didn't. But people aged 18 at that time that left English schools, whatever they were, comprehensive or grammar schools or whatever was kicking about, only 3% of them went on to university. That seems about right to me. I could probably even name that 3% in my year. There was a half a dozen guys or whatever it was, you know. I can't remember. There's about 120 in the year. There's probably half a dozen guys, maybe a dozen or something. A few really very, very bright, astonishingly bright people, you know, got in at Oxford and Cambridge. For them, you go, yeah, absolutely. You can see that they've got certain gifts mathematically, or their scientific minds were exceptional. You know, I'm crap at certain things. And, you know, I think one of the first thing is to admit where you're weak and look where you might be strong and play to those strengths and sort of cover your weaknesses. But now I understand that 33%, it might be even higher than that, go on to university. So I'm expected to believe there's been an 11-fold increase in the sorts of people who have an intellectual aptitude for the refined training and specific thought fields that come with universities. It's simply not true. I mean, it's been part of, that's why they've got all these idiot courses, you know, whatever it is, duck hypnotizing or some stupid nonsense. I mean, you just see these sort of idiot courses that they're taking. Half of them are always about diversity, equity, and inclusion, all this other stuff. It's very, very sad. Just complete
in the military, it was how they differentiated officers, was they had the education. They would go to the universities to pick out who would be the officers in the military here. Mm-hmm. And then gradually, as time has gone on, they got rid of the draft. And now that the main way to get draft, you know, instead of having a draft, they have student debt. Mm-hmm. And that the debt collector then becomes the military recruiter, because it's then, well, we'll pay off your debt. Just join the military for this amount of years and you'll have all your student debt paid off. And that's Yippee. That's been the main way of collecting, you know, soldiers to go fight these wars, these unjust wars. And they do it with these because they know, oh, well, they advertise you, you're worthless unless you get a higher education. And you need this. And so they get these unqualified people in there because they know, oh, this will be perfect cannon fodder for our war to go collect more debt from another country.
I know. Well,
and the that's why here the government is the main source of student loans. You basically pay it back to the federal government. There's only one bank, and that's Wells Fargo, that's allowed to give out student loans. Otherwise, it's all through the federal government. And if you don't pay back your debt, then you're screwed.
So go to university, learn some ridiculous topic that's got no practical use in the world at all and that you could do as a hobby for the rest of your life if you were so inclined, run up a huge debt, and then spend X number of years paying that debt off, which means that reduces your chances of being able to buy a house. I don't know why I even said that. They're building two houses near me, which are the same design on the same site that was built 25 years ago, which was before we arrived here. And I was watching them put them up the other week. These things are going to go for £500,000. They're detached houses because there's only a four-foot gap between each house, about 4 foot. It might not even be that. This is allowed under planning permission. And the first floor is made out of brick, but the upper floor, which is eaves, is made out of wood. The whole thing is just wood. And I was looking at it and said, oh, that looks really cheap to put that up. So the foundations and the first floor are, you know, a proper building. But the bit on top, I don't think so. And so young couples are faced with what? Not being young couples. Is there any, are we surprised why they don't get together with a view to becoming parents and families? It's absolutely, it's completely bonkers and broken. But of course, this is just another aspect of this systemic destruction by all these agents, effectively, that we're having to, you know, deal with or find ways of dealing with them. That's really what we're looking at. We're coming towards the end of the show. I've got this other song. I'm going to play out with this other version of Istanbul, Not Constantinople by the Four Lads. Okay, it's 2 minutes and 20 seconds long, so I'm going to have to play pretty soon, actually. We've got 2.5. Any last little words for the show, Paul? You got anything you'd like to just wrap up with?
I'm going to have to be careful not to say too much because every time I open my microphone, one of my computers here suffers a packet storm. after my rant about the solar subsidies, one of my computers, the named Studio C, had 19,000 packet hits.
Right,
19,000 packet hits within 3 minutes of my saying that.
Right.
Well, I say, don't lose hope.
I have to be careful not to say too much.
Don't lose hope. Thanks, Paul.
I'm going to have to be careful.
Thanks, Patrick. Thank you, Paul. Thanks, everyone in the chat. It's been brilliant. Really good free-flowing thing all over the place this week. We're going to play out with Istanbul, Not Constantinople by the Four Lads. I'll be back here again same time next week. Thanks, everyone in the chat. Here we go.
Not Constantinople, been a long time gone. Old Constantinople still is Turkish delight on a moonlit night. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, not Constantinople. So if you've a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul. Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say.
People just liked it better that way.
Take me back to Constantinople.
No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Why did Constantinople get the works? That's nobody's business but the Turks. Amsterdam.
why they changed it, I can't say.
People just liked it better that way.
Take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Why did Constantinople get the works?